This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. The Friday Pitch-In is where we kind of break format and do a show that's not just about one thing. Coming up, we'll talk to health reporter Jill Sheridan about a new dementia therapy being tried out that's showing some very promising results. And later, I'll chat with author Richard Louv about his new book, Our Wild Calling, which is about how being mindful of our relationships with animals can greatly improve our lives. He's appearing at Butler University for a talk at Clues Hall tonight. But first, my favorite part of the week, where we get caught up on the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. We call her the News Queen. Digital producer Lauren Chapman is here. Hi, Lauren.
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm well, but I feel like weather should be among what we talk about because we saw a big temperature drop for Halloween. It snowed on Halloween.
Snowed. I'm one of those garbage people who actually loves snow, and so
I like snow too.
I went outside after I got to my grandparents' house, dressed as a LaCroix can, and danced in their front yard as trick or treaters went up to their door.
A LaCroix can.
Yes.
That's a refreshing costume. So Halloween was weird. But let's look at the actual news. HIP 2.0, there was a work requirement. Now that's been challenged. What's going on here?
Yeah, so Indiana's Family and Social Services Administration, or FSSA, has temporarily suspended work requirements for people on the Healthy Indiana Plan, or HIP. And the move is actually in response to a federal lawsuit that was filed last month. It encapsulates a lot of what other states are seeing. The lawsuit that was basically to understand everything, you kind of have to understand what work requirements are.
Yeah.
So essentially, they are designed to be a way to get people off of Medicaid. So Indiana's work requirements were announced in February 2018, and HIP came before the Medicaid expansion. So our program in the state is seen as a model for how to increase insurance for low-income people and ultimately get them off of HIP. Those work requirements were announced through a waiver from the Trump administration to get people working. A few things off of that, there's a lot of critics say that people who are on Medicaid who can work already do work. Mm. So a lot of states have seen these lawsuits. A lot of states have attempted to implement work requirements, and it's kind of a little bit of a mess right now.
Mm, I guess so. So let's look at the federal lawsuit. Mm-hmm. and what it means. So what are we doing here?
Yeah. So there are three work requirements that have already faced federal lawsuits, including Arkansas, Kentucky, and New Hampshire. New Hampshire's was stopped. Arkansas's was also stopped, but it was stopped after it had already started. So there were a lot of people who lost their insurance, to the tune of 18,000 people.
Wow.
And Kentucky's was stopped before it was allowed to be implemented. And so these work requirements are different for each state. Indiana's is considered one of the more lax because it's just designed, it's built entirely to be different than those other states. So for Indiana's work requirements, you're allowed to use education, volunteerism as options for logging hours to qualify for this work requirement. And it progressively ramps up. So the actual launch was supposed to be January 2020, when people would start losing insurance. The program itself was launched earlier this year. Jill Sheridan, our health reporter, and Carter Barrett for Side Effects Public Media had heard from sources that Indiana wasn't getting good reporting, and some people actually would have started to lose their benefits in January. So in response to this, the state has said, hey, you know what? Let's see where these federal lawsuits go. Let's see how things shake out before we start taking more drastic actions.
So this is just a suspension of these work requirements,
yeah.
Rather. They may come back.
Absolutely. Yeah. And because of how inherently different Indiana's work requirements are from some of these other states, it could very well happen.
So what does it mean for HIP, or HIP 2.0, as we call it?
Yeah. So what it means is that folks who are on Medicaid, who need who are doing these work requirements, who are reporting their hours, are supposed to continue reporting their hours. That helps connect them to other resources throughout the state. That is one of the things that makes Indiana so much different, is that it connects them to education and workforce resources through the state government. So after making sure that they continue to log their hours, but at as of January 2020, they're not supposed to lose their benefits yet.
Hmm. Okay. Well, they may come back.
They may come back.
Okay. All right. So let's look up toward Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. Another spill up there, this time from U.S. Steel. What happened?
So this is actually the third spill in as many months. U.S. Steel.
From them?
From U.S. Steel.
Oh, okay.
Specifically. They had two oil leaks, one in August and one in September. But this most recent one was a spill of, which was slightly over its limit from IDEM, for hexavalent chromium. It's a cancer-causing chemical, which 2 years ago they discharged 300 pounds of into the Burns Waterway, which is Lake Michigan, everything, basically.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So two years ago this happened, and now it's happened again with this same chemical.
Same chemical. By no means is it the same amount, because 300 pounds is so much more than what they experienced this time. But it's still, it's part of that similar trend, right, where IDEM released their report last week that we talked about with ArcelorMittal saying that they weren't reporting quick enough. U.S. Steel seems to have reported very quickly, but it's that same sort of keeping everything in the conversation about what exactly is being put out into Lake Michigan and its subsequent waterways.
So they reported it quick enough, mm-hmm. As opposed to what happened with ArcelorMittal. Mm-hmm. When did it happen? Do we have the date on when exactly it happened? It was recent.
Yes, it was Wednesday evening.
So this past Wednesday evening.
Yeah.
Okay, so we know about it now. It's on the news now. Mm-hmm. I would say that's a quick enough response.
That's a pretty quick turnaround, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get into Indiana and how we performed on the nation's report card. I guess we're part of a national trend, but not a really great trend.
Yes. So the nation's report card, also known as the National Assessment of Educational Progress, released their report card this week. And what they saw was something that we already knew. I learned test results came back. We knew that Hoosier students' test results had dropped. That was the same thing that the nation's report card also noted. But what's part of that larger conversation is that all across the board, reading scores went down across the country, except for one state in one particular grade, which was fourth grade Mississippi students.
Really?
Yes.
I feel like whenever I see something like this, Mississippi is almost always toward the bottom, mm-hmm. At least historically in years past, in fairly recent years. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a surprise.
Yeah, Mississippi has fundamentally rethought a lot of its education and how it teaches.
Because of these poor rankings?
Yeah.
Sort of across the board?
They kind of got tired of being last.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, especially for reading.
Yeah.
So Mississippi has seen some positive results out of that. But all across the country, and one of the things that came out after Jeannie Lindsay's story, our education reporter, was the executive director for the NAEP was basically like, we need to fundamentally rethink how we are teaching reading to students, because she had pointed to a couple of things with, teaching to standardized testing and teaching for the test instead of teaching fundamental, reading comprehension skills.
Mm. And so we're focusing on how Indiana is part of a national trend of reading proficiency going down. But State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick says that actually, yeah, that went down, but we're doing pretty well elsewhere.
Yeah, she said that not only do the scores not provide a total reflection of student achievement, but the scores themselves have actually improved for different groups, like special needs students, students of color, and English learners, which are huge groups that, generally speaking, get left behind when we do see improvement.
Okay. Next up, the RV industry. We are seeing for the first time some growth month to month when we compare to last year. What are we looking at?
Yeah, the RV Industry Association is reporting a slight uptick in September shipments compared to September 2018 shipments.
Okay.
And this is the first time in more than a year that the industry has seen any positive growth over the previous year.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So things are looking okay.
They're improving a little bit.
But nowhere near the success of last year.
No. In fact, RV shipments so far in 2019 are down 20% from this time last year, which is concerning because the RV industry tends to be a bellwether for the economy as a whole. So this is a nice thing to see and a hopeful sign of the economy. But it's also, in the larger picture, you know, still worrisome. A lot of the things that we've heard about, especially with national NPR stories, with a lot of the stories that we've done statewide, you know, there are a lot of indicators for a recession coming up. And this is one where it's like, well, pump the brakes. Maybe it's not going to be so bad, but also still keep an eye out. Be cautious.
Yeah, definitely be cautious because, again, we're looking at month to month. So if you look at January of this year versus January 2018, and February, March, every single month has been significantly higher. You've got a great bar graph on the website that kind of illustrates what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we're talking about September, right?
Yes.
September numbers. Just ever so slightly higher than 2018.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I must say that All In did a show on the RV industry. So
it's definitely the All In effect. I will co-sign that. It's definitely the All In effect. You guys said that it was a cheaper cost now. So people said, oh, I'm going to go buy an RV.
You know what? And I might be one of those people where my wife and I are actually thinking about buying a travel trailer. We're trying to determine when the best time of year is to buy. I think it might be right now. I don't know. We're doing a lot of research. So maybe we'll be helping that out here before too long.
And you're just messing with the bellwether of the economy by doing so.
Well, we love doing that. Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, thank you as always for filling us in on the week's news.
Thank you so much for having me.
And have a good weekend, too, by the way. Up next, how can music treat dementia patients? Health reporter Jill Sheridan's been following this for some time and has some updates on a new therapy that's bringing back memories. If you have experience with this, we want to hear from you. How effective has therapy been for your loved ones with dementia? What works for them? What hasn't? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your questions and comments in front of Jill next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the Friday pitch-in, I want to tell you about a show we did yesterday on school referendums across the state, which that many districts will be voting on this coming Tuesday, Election Day. We talked with some experts about how much money districts are asking for and what they want to do with it and what it could mean for schools across the state. And you can find a podcast of that and all past shows at WFYI.org/all in and wherever you get podcasts. And you can also find us on Stitcher, which is a free download. Today is the Friday Pitch-In, where we break down this week's headlines and explore a few more stories in depth. And as always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. What stories were in the news this week that you have questions about or would like us to dig into? We'd always love to hear which topics matter to you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And we're back now talking about a new prescription, if you will, for patients with dementia. Jill Sheridan, Indiana Public Broadcasting's health reporter, joins us today to tell about it. Jill, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So what are we hearing right now? Who
isn't it great?
Who's singing? I suppose.
This is the Song Shape Chorus.
Okay.
All right, this chorus. Listen for a second. They're so awesome. Made up of 28 people from Indiana, people with dementia or Alzheimer's, mid to late stage, or early to mid-stage Alzheimer's, and their caregivers. They're making up this choir who's been practicing for the last 8 weeks. And it's just a really unique and interesting experience for these people and something that's kind of new here in Indiana.
They really don't sound too bad.
No, they sound great. And it is great because it's a chance not only for them to come together and, you know, explore themselves, their music abilities, but also the social interaction is really important for these people and their caregivers to experience this together. So it's really cool to go see.
So this music is a form of therapy for them.
Yeah. I mean, you could call it music therapy. I think other people might call it an intervention. When we're talking about music therapy, something that's becoming more popular, that you're seeing a lot of places, older homes for seniors using music for interventions, or just generally caregivers using music in their in-home settings to help with all sorts of different problems that are associated with aging, with dementia and Alzheimer's. So this project between the Resonance Initiative and Sequoia, which is an aging agency here in Indiana, is really sort of exploring a new way that you can use music to help people with Alzheimer's or dementia.
And this isn't the first time you've reported on something like this, right?
That's true. I really enjoy reporting on music and for people who are aging and suffering from this disease. I guess because there's a lot of really interesting things that are happening in Indiana. And in the past, I've done some stories as we're looking at state-funded research and other projects to create personalized playlists for people with Alzheimer's and dementia, and see if we can start to understand, you know, what the real impact is of music for people, because, you know, there's not a lot of therapies for people with Alzheimer's and dementia.
So what is the relationship between our brains and music? Does music hold a special place in memory?
This is something that we're still learning. I was reading some information out of PubMed today. Just last year, they had done a comprehensive study looking at 28 different studies that had explored this. But again, we don't have a whole lot of concrete information. There needs to be more randomized trials to really understand what that relationship is. But from what we know now, key areas that are linked to memory are not impacted by Alzheimer's and dementia in the way that of the brain are not impacted in the way that other parts of the brain are. So the part that stores music, the part of your brain that remembers music, is independent of other parts of the brain. So that's some of our understanding of why music holds this special place in memory and why people with Alzheimer's or dementia are able to recall music and have a connection to it in a way that they might not other parts of their lives.
Is there a particular type of music that our brain can recall better than others, or is it all just the same? It's just music.
We're finding, again, from emerging studies, that it is that music that really had an impact in your life in those formative years, in your late teens, in your early 20s. I think a lot of people can sort of relate to that anyway. I mean, that's the music that kind of sticks with you just inherently, that you still love and explore as a person. And the way that the brain stores that information, that music information, we're learning that might be a possible reason that particular music in a person's life might have the most impact when we're using it as an intervention or a therapy for people with Alzheimer's and dementia.
I would imagine songs, actual singing, has to come into play here more so than maybe recalling instrumental or, you know, jazz pieces or something like that.
Or just listening, yes. I mean, that's another thing that we're seeing more studies and more information coming out, that the actual, you know, physical part of singing and even moving, and, you know, that's why this choir is an interesting exploration, because the whole process of making music seems to also be more beneficial for people with this disease.
I have small children. You have small children. You know, we sing these simple children's songs and things like that we've remembered from our own childhood. We're passing on to our kids. Maybe this is the sort of thing that they're recalling as well as popular music from their formative years. So they're able to recall this music, but are they able to learn new music as
well? And again,
well,
we need to have more studies. We need to have more information about this. But there are a couple of studies. One I was reading about a violin player with late stage of Alzheimer's who was able to learn new music, actually learn a new piece of music. So, you know, that's, I think, very promising, you know, in my personal opinion about what we could be thinking about when we think about music and memory.
Now, his example, or hers, his or her example, it is is sort of the exception. I mean, they were an actual musician.
Yeah. Right.
And so their profession was playing an instrument. And so for them, it goes beyond the song aspect, singing.
Right.
But that's still
information's in your brain.
It's still
already
pretty impressive. The information's in their brain already. They've played music before. And they're able to learn new things. Was this surprise? I mean, you may not know the details, but was this surprising to their caregivers?
To the researchers, I think it was, you know, a bit surprising and just, you know, really promising as well. But again, large randomized clinical trials are the ways that you really start to prove this when we're talking about the science of music and memory.
And again, this is an emerging level of therapy. But what are the treatment or therapy options currently available to patients with dementia that are sort of established or proven?
Well, that's kind of the problem, is that there are no medical FDA-approved treatments for Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, we've got Lily right down the street, you know, working hard to find something. And the current thinking to try to find medication is around these plaques that build up in your brain. But they found that might necessarily be the clue. So we have no medicine. And oftentimes, you know, drugs that are given for people with dementia or Alzheimer's tend to be antidepressants or other antipsychotic drugs that might actually have a bad effect. So when we're talking about therapies, occupational therapy, behavioral therapy, a lot of it's very limited because of what that person might be able to engage in as well. So music tends to be something that is easy and also accessible.
Getting back to Lily, they spent a lot of time and effort into developing what they thought would be an effective Alzheimer's drug, and they had to scrap it a number of years ago. And you've got top people here in town at Lily trying to work on this problem and find a medication-type solution for it, and it is really proving to be difficult.
It's very difficult. And so, you know, that's why a lot of people are focusing on other interventions, because, you know, we've got to make some headway somewhere.
You spoke with Tim Brimmer, a professor of music education at Butler, and he's been studying the effects that music can have on people with these conditions. What he found?
So it is really, and he's such a great character, Professor Brimmer, and he's been doing this work. And I did this story with him a couple years ago when he had this state-funded research project, and went over to a senior home and was able to talk to some people. He used his Butler students, to come and, you know, question them about what music was impactful for them, and made these personalized playlists for people, and he was able to find some, you know, really interesting information about these sundowning symptoms, which is what happens when you do have Alzheimer's and you are in late stage Alzheimer's. It can be aggressiveness, it can be agitation, confusion, receptiveness of things that are happening around you. And his findings, he had 300 people participating in this study, and combined playlists playing more than 10,000 times. His data showed that there was great significant change with residents' engagement, which I guess maybe we could guess, but also a reduction in agitation, highly significant finding there, because agitation is one of the last symptoms to diagnose and one of the hardest to treat. So some really interesting stuff. I was able to chat with a guy that was there at the home, a 101-year-old yodeler, and he remembered all of the yodeling songs. And I had heard him down the hall, was interviewing another patient there, but I had to go run to the yodeler. And he really made the story.
Got to hear the yodeler. And I understand that did you talk to Tim?
Yes, we talked to Tim. And for this story, I chatted with him. The story's going to be out today at States, but he was also had a lot of information about, you know, the positive brain chemicals, and I'll let you hear from Tim here.
The neurotransmitters are lighting up like crazy. Neurotransmitters. There are four of them in particular that are really, really healthy for us. They're called the happy quartet. We need them every day. Dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins. For some reason, when we music, we make a whole lot of all four of them, and it's from all different kinds of activities.
So that's where his research really now is focusing, you know, adding in movement, adding in experiences like a choir can give you to really understand, you know, how these brain chemicals, these positive brain chemicals, might influence someone who's dealing with this disease.
Getting back to song shape chorus, which we heard at the top of this segment, what kind of results or feedback have they gotten?
So, I mean, it's been, as you might guess, really positive for most of the participants there. And the couple times that I went out and experienced it, you know, they're at Prime Life in Richmond, which is a senior aging activity center in Carmel, Indiana, and lots of opportunities for people to engage there. But you just feel in the energy in the room. I mean, people are having a great time. They're really having fun with the people that they're with, because the caregivers are there with them too, you know, and it has a really positive experience for that caregiver and also meeting new friends. And then they have a social time afterwards. So it's just been really great to watch them. The director, Rick Cobb, the choir director, he's from Resonance Initiative, and he's done a lot of this work around the city, but this is the first time he's doing this with dementia and Alzheimer's patients. You know, he says, again, that connection has just really been key.
For that mom that's suffering with this disease and the daughter who's brought her mom to rehearsal to be able to connect, and for that mom to say, you know what, yeah, that's the mom that I knew.
And then I was lucky enough to talk with that mom and her daughter, who's her daughter's Lauren O'Neill. The mother is Tina Bavona. Tina used to have a jazz bar in the Jersey Shore that her daughter had a reminder of. They wouldn't let the boss play there because he didn't play jazz. But like all these great musical memories, and they were just an amazing like team. You know, when I interviewed them and talked to them about their experience and all the things that she was able to help her mother remember, and that her mother really, I mean, she feels lucky. Her mom is still, you know, very present, and she's still able to, you know, communicate really well. And this was just the perfect activity for them together. But her mother, Tina, who has dementia, really experienced a good experience as well.
Yes, I just couldn't. I'm going to start crying. I just couldn't believe it. When Lauren brought me here, I'm thinking, I'm not going to know anybody. And then I know all that, what's going on with the songs and doing things.
She was recalling all the connections to her mother and the music that they used to play and those things that were meaningful to her. So it was really cool.
Are there any other choirs like this out there? Anywhere else is being done?
I mean, not in Indiana that I could find, but there are other states. This is kind of a growing trend. I found a couple up in Minnesota. Again, sort of a trend that we're seeing as people are trying to find new interventions using music.
You've spoken with Dementia Friends USA. Can you talk a little bit about what this group is trying to accomplish?
Yeah, because Dementia Friends is actually with an initiative, a statewide initiative now. They just went statewide from SECOA, the aging agency, and this partnership with Resonance Initiative. So Dementia Friends, this fits right in with their work. Dementia Friends is sort of an outreach, education awareness program, telling people and places that they can make just small changes in their lives, in their organizations, to reduce stigma and make places more friendly and accepting of people with Alzheimer's and dementia. So for a restaurant, it might be, you know, being aware that your music is too loud and that might affect somebody that's coming in, or a lighting for an organization, because that can be an issue as well. Or just making small changes to reduce stigma and make people aware that, you know, people with Alzheimer's and dementia don't have to be, you know, afraid to go out. And their caregivers don't have to be afraid to, you know, take them out because of this disease. They can still, you know, lead a full life.
Yeah, this isn't exactly something that's top of mind for those of us who don't have dementia patients to care for. What else makes a more dementia-friendly community?
So I think it is pretty simple. And if you go online, SECOA and Dementia Friends Indiana, now lots of organizations are signing up, lots of individuals signing up, and they make it pretty simple steps that you can go through to sort of take a look at your organization and your place and make sure that you're doing things that will invite people in, that will engage people with Alzheimer's and dementia. Because I think in the past, you know, we've kind of just sort of put those people away and said, you know, this is what it's going to be, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. And maybe, you know, this is a good intervention for people to keep engaged with those that they love and the things that they love to do.
There's a lot of hope along with this. Does the Song Shape Chorus perform publicly?
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to be performing November 10th at the Tabernacle Presbyterian, 34th and Meridian, I believe that is. So they'll be performing a whole set. The music was chosen by the participants and by the caregivers. So he sent out a questionnaire at first to be like, what songs, again, thinking about, how important the music is and the personalized music is. So everybody sort of chose the music. We're going to, you'll be able to hear some Elvis, some Frank Sinatra.
That real memory driving popular stuff. So we got a message from Hillary on Facebook. She says, I'm a board certified music therapist. In order for something to be called music therapy, it must be facilitated by a board certified music therapist. Otherwise, it's just a musical activity. Music therapists have specific training to facilitate towards goals, and we practice evidence-based techniques. Music can be beneficial to all, but not all music is therapy. Jill, you talked about the right wording earlier. Is it best to call this an activity that supports memory rather than music therapy, I wonder?
Right.
I think that's what she's getting at.
I think it was safest to say that it's an intervention, not necessarily calling it, therapy, but an activity that, that does support memory.
Jill Sheridan, she's a health reporter for our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis and Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jill, thanks for your work.
Oh, thank you so much.
Up next, author Richard Louv has written extensively about the problem of nature deficiency, the fact that not enough of us are getting enough nature in our lives. His best-selling book, Last Child in the Woods, looks at, among other things, the mental health benefits of regular natural experiences outdoors away from technology. Next week, he's out with the new book, Our Wild Calling. Can you recall a time when nature improved or even saved your life? How often do you get outside? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We'll share your comments with author Richard Louv next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. When was the last time you spent more than an hour outdoors away from technology, really taking it all in? Sure, maybe you had your phone on you. Who doesn't these days? But maybe you didn't look at it at all. I would say most people couldn't recall the last time that happened, much less the last time they didn't even peek at their phone for over an hour. What does this do to us mentally, emotionally? How much does losing touch with nature affect us? Richard Louv writes about the significance of our growing disconnect with natural places. He's the author of the bestseller Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. His new book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs, comes out next week. Richard, welcome.
Thank you.
You're talking to us today because you're in town for a talk at Butler University tonight. What's that going to be about?
Well, it's going to focus on all the issues we're talking about here. Also on my new book. This is the first city, I think. It may be the first city where the book's available at the speech to buy, and which is always a good thing. And that book is called Our Wild Calling, and it's about our relationship with other animals and how they transform our lives and how we can save theirs.
So before we get to the new book, I want to ask about Last Child in the Woods. When I heard about that book, I thought, this is exactly the problem. Kids aren't getting outside enough. And this came out in 2005. Yeah. It seems so much worse now. Tablets are everywhere. Kids are plugged in constantly. I mean, every parent wants a break. Give the kid a tablet. Who can blame him? But what do you say is the kind of damage that we're suffering by not going outside?
Well, the way to measure that is to measure the research on how good it is for us and then imagine taking that away. When I wrote Last Child in the Woods, and it was published, as you say, in 2005, before iPhones. Pagers were on the scene and all of that, and certainly television and computers and video games. It's a little too easy to blame electronics. For that, there's also these other factors like parental fear of stranger danger, which is largely created by news media, by my profession, that fear, not the fact. Some neighborhoods it is very dangerous. But that's part of it, but also bad urban design. We get preached to walk all the time. Walk where? In some neighborhoods. You'll run into a freeway. But in terms of the research, at that time there was very little research in 2005 on this, on something so large. It was amazing to me that the effect of the natural world on child development, on human development throughout our lives was just not being studied very much. There was a few pioneers. There were about 60 studies that I could find at that time. Now there are – it's going on 1,000 studies, and they're still coming in at about 10 to 15 a month from somewhere in the world. So now that study of this issue is something of a growth industry. Attention deficit disorder, the symptoms go down a lot with just a little bit of contact with nature, even in an urban place, walking through trees in an urban park. Cognitive functioning. It's easier to be creative when you spend more time in nature. It helps us learn. It excites our senses so that we take in information more. So it's good for standardized tests, believe it or not. Now there's research in Massachusetts and Chicago about the schools that have greened themselves, and I don't mean solar panels. I mean actual
green space.
Yeah, the green space. They've got natural play spaces and so forth. Those schools, the kids do much better on standardized testing. And this factors out social economic issues that might throw that off. So it's across the board. So psychological well-being, mental health, physical health, people who walk on treadmills in an indoor gym compared to another group of people doing similar exercise but doing it outdoors, and both groups burning exactly the same amount of calories. The people doing it outdoors do even better. Both groups do better in terms of blood pressure and psychological health and all that. But if you do it outdoors, there's some value added we don't quite understand. So on and on, this research says this is elemental to our humanity. This is not a nice to have. This is a have to have.
I've never quite understood why someone would choose indoor on a treadmill versus outdoor. Some days are nicer than others, of course. There are some people, though, and I know a few of them, who just don't like being outside. They have a narrow temperature tolerance, or maybe they suffer from allergies, or who knows what. I'm lucky to not have any of that personally. So being out in nature is my jam, per se, but it isn't everybody's. Do you disagree?
Well, E.O. Wilson at Harvard, a great famous scientist, came up with a theory a few decades ago called the biophilia hypothesis, biophilia's love of life. Basically, what he's saying is that we are genetically wired as a species to have an affiliation with the rest of nature. When we don't get enough, we don't do so well. So I make the argument that this should be considered a human right. And yes, you're right. Some people – this isn't for everybody. I mean some – but even people that you might assume it's not for instance, I have a friend who's the head of a big environmental organization. He has a young boy who has agoraphobia, has some other conditions that he can't go outside. Mm. So on the way back home after I'd visited him one day, I stopped at the airport and there was a book about cloud spotting. I sent it to him. So he can sit in his room and he can look out the window and he can cloud spot. There's a lot you can see just from a bedroom window, and that needs to be factored in too.
Let's get to the new book, Our Wild Calling. I love how much empathy comes up on about every other page. How do we learn about and even get better at empathy through connecting with animals?
Well, one of the effects of connecting with nature, particularly with other animals, is – in young children in particular, is the development of empathy. We have forgotten that in many ways. We have made animals into data too much. Environmentalism does this. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself an environmentalist, but I think we've lost some of our heart. You know, everything is about inches. Everything is about how much the ocean has gone up or number of endangered species, but what about our connection to the species itself, to the individual animal? So in Our Wild Calling, I collected a lot of stories that people sent me, that I interviewed people about these really life-changing encounters they have with a coyote, with a hawk. And also their ongoing relationships, maybe with the wild animals in their neighborhood, and ongoing relationships with their companion animals. I don't make a severe separation between our dogs and cats and mountain lions. Mm-hmm. We really should think about these animals and their effect on us. And these stories are just – some of them are deeply moving. Oftentimes people haven't told those stories before they told them to me because they're embarrassed. Because it might sound like anthropomorphism or that they're having some kind of a spiritual woo-woo experience, but they do. people do. Hardcore scientists do.
Yeah, it's all very well researched, and it references a lot of what's already been written. But you also don't really you don't waste our time as a reader getting into the weeds with like academic things. What I really love are all those anecdotes that you talked about that kind of tie everything together. You're quick to disclaim that that's not science, as you just said, but it is incredibly relatable. The stories about interacting with animals and the profound effects that they've had on their subjects. I guess what's a good example from the book that illustrates just what we're talking about here?
Well, I'll give a short one and then a longer one.
Okay.
Maybe a couple longer. The short one is about a dog. And again, I talk about pets in here too. I met a woman in Toronto who walked into her – she had a six-year-old son and a big dog named Jack. And one day she walked into the living room and both of them are stretched out on the rug and her son has his arm around the dog, around Jack. And she hears her son say very softly, "Mommy, I don't have a heart anymore." And she says, "What are you saying?" And he said, "My heart is in Jack."
Oh.
You know, that permeability, that, you know, this connection that it goes so deep. And children tend to understand that. We can remember that, and we tend to forget it. We tend to move away. You move that back into your life, and life becomes a lot richer and a lot less alone. Another story. This is a story about an oceanographer at Scrimsys Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, where I live. He's a famous oceanographer. He's in his, I think, early 80s now, named Paul Dayton. He was on the bottom of the ocean once, taking samples with his scuba gear. And he felt something really large come above him and stop. It's usually not a good sign. and he kind of looks up a little bit and he sees a long tendril come down and then another one. And he looked up and he said it was a really large, big octopus, the kind with 12-foot wingspan or leg span, tentacle span. And he said, risking anthropomorphism, he says, "It decided I was a clam and it came down and got me."
Oh, my.
And it wrapped him up in its tentacles, hard tentacles. He said, "People think those are soft. They're not. They're hard as iron. You can't get them off." These tentacles are interesting because they're filled with photons. Essentially, they can kind of see with their arms, with their tentacles. Mm. That's where the brains, many of the brains of the octopus are in the arms. And so it was really getting to know Paul. And about that time, he realizes he's not going to escape, and he's running out of oxygen.
Oh, my goodness.
So he kind of relaxes. He does what prey often does, in the gazelle in the mouth of the lion. He relaxed instinctively. The octopus relaxed a little bit. And with the last strength he had, he kicked off the bottom. They go up in the column of water higher and higher. As they're going up, he feels the razor-sharp beak of the octopus moving around his neck until he is looking into the octopus's eye.
Mm.
And right far up into this thing, he said, "I think we made a non-aggression pact."
Wow.
And he bursts out of the water. And what does Paul do? He's looking at the octopus right below the surface, and he watches the octopus turn into the shape of a space shuttle, and he watches it disappear into the darkness. What does Paul do? He rips off his mask and he chases the octopus down. I said, "Paul," and he follows it down until he can't see it anymore, but no oxygen. "Why would you do that, Paul?" He says, "I have no clue, except that I felt like my life changed at that point." And he actually used the word spiritual, and this isn't common.
This is a scientist. Yeah.
This is a hardcore scientist. He said there was something that happened there.
Mm. You also write that there's an epidemic of loneliness because of our disconnect with animals. Can you explain that?
Medical, the word epidemic, which I do use, but I also say that's a little controversial among some medical folks to consider this an epidemic, but I think it probably is. Medical folks are now saying that loneliness, social isolation, may soon surpass obesity as a reason for death, as a cause of disease and death. Not just suicide, but all kinds of diseases that are associated with it. a lot of people blame that on Facebook and all of that. And one of the amazing studies is a generational study. It says the younger people are generationally, the more lonelier they are. Hmm. It used to be that older people were the loneliness. Now it's flipped. What does that say about a society where the younger you are, the lonelier you are? I make the case that our society, electronics, has something to do with that, but that it's rooted in something deeper, which is species loneliness. The parks, the urban parks that have the best impact on human psychological health are the parks with highest biodiversity. Right. I don't think that's an accident. I think we're desperate to not feel alone in the universe.
One of the fascinating theories that you bring up, we always think of the domestication of animals, dogs, cats, livestock, as one of the earliest ways we may have shown our dominion over the natural world. But you and others argue that humans may have indeed been domesticated by other animals. Wolves, we come to think of, that our ape brains may not have started with this potential for intelligence and empathy that we enjoy today, that indeed we may have developed that through our interaction with the complex social structure of wolves. I'd never heard or thought of that before, but it makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, in the section in Our Wild Calling where I write about that, I write about my own dog, my collie that I spent much of my boyhood with in the woods. My parents didn't know where I was, but the dog did. I, at one point, wrote something where I thought my dog taught me ethics, some ethics.
Okay.
I was taken to task on that by an animal behavioralist. And I was looking into it, and then I find these papers. They're German scientists who say that it could be that rather than us domesticating wolves by drawing them to our campfire with bones and all that, that we may have been domesticated by them. What that means is we followed them. We watched them hunt. We saw how cooperative they were. We saw what great families they had. They took care of each other. And that influenced us. I mean, primates aren't the nicest animals. You know, the chimpanzees are kind of – they're not
– violence
yeah,
there.
Yeah. And so are wolves, but they're more cooperative. And so we learn maybe how to hunt by following them. And these scientists, this paper actually used the word ethics. So suddenly, Banner, my dog, made a lot of sense, and I hope that the behavioralist reads that chapter.
How has our relationship with animals emerged as an issue in next year's presidential race?
One of the candidates, and I don't know, I'm blanking on this, guy from Florida, I'm sorry, has actually introduced legislation that is essentially animal rights legislation that would protect, the adoption agencies for rescue pets and all of that. It's complicated, but also our treatment of wild animals. Now, that hasn't gotten a lot of press, but it's amazing that it emerges in a presidential race.
Mm. And we read all the time about therapy animals, service dogs and cats and all manner of pets, usually mammals that have been given this sort of official designation. Why is this one of the biggest healthcare trends right now? We got about a minute or so left.
Well, because a lot of people are self-medicating with animals. We have more dogs than ever in the United States. There are more dogs in Toronto than there are children. And this comes in two forms, the service animals that are highly trained and then the companion animals that sometimes aren't, you know, this is the ostrich that gets on the plane with the passenger.
Right.
Always awkward. Some of that we have to be sympathetic to because people hurt and they're finding a sense of companionship and they're being relieved of all kinds of things, including their loneliness. And that we can't underestimate that. And I I do want to talk about that more tonight. And by the way, the tickets are free. I'm a cheap date.
So. Ah, tickets are free. As I was going to get to that. Richard Louv is the author of the book Our Wild Calling. It's out next week, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. He's talking at Butler University tonight at Clues Hall, 7 o'clock if you're interested. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Get the podcast wherever you find podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be talking about some of the things happening at this year's Spirit and Place Festival in Indianapolis. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.